Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
It's a complicated political marriage at this point.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. This is our weekly roundup, where we invite a rotating panel of experts to discuss the truth you need to know behind the most important stories of the week and how they're shaping the political landscape. On today's panel, returning to the roundup, is Liam Donovan. Liam has nearly two decades of experience working at the intersection of politics and policy. He's currently a principal at Bracewell LLP and spent two election cycles at the National Republican Senatorial Committee, where we worked together. And he was the regional finance director for Senator John Cornyn. He's also the host of The Lobby Shop. Liam, it's great to have you back.
Good to be back, Ron.
And making his Politicology debut, Alex Thompson. Alex is Axios' national political correspondent covering the 2024 election. He was previously a White House correspondent for Politico, where he created their daily West Wing playbook. Before that, he wrote for Vice News and assisted Maureen Dowd at the New York Times and researched and helped edit her New York Times bestselling book, The Year of Voting Dangerously. Alex, welcome to Politicology.
So good to be here.
And a little later on, we'll be joined by Mark Polymeropoulos, who served in the CIA for 26 years in operational field and leadership assignments across the Middle East, Europe, and Asia. He's an expert in counterterrorism, covert action, and human intelligence collection, and is the author of Clarity in Crisis, Leadership Lessons from the CIA. Up first this week, Donald Trump's completely expected landslide victory in the Iowa caucus and some of the very bad takes about what the results mean. Then I'll patch in Mark, and we'll look at the rising tensions in the Middle East and the chance of further escalation. Later, we'll discuss the Democratic primary race, New Hampshire feeling the impact of the Biden-friendly primary calendar, and what a win would actually look like for him on Tuesday. Then our panel will tell us about the developments they're watching and why. After the main show, we'll tape our Politicology Plus episode, where we're going to talk about the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos and the garish displays of wealth when the wealth gap is widening. To join us for that discussion, plus more ad-free episodes, all on a private podcast feed, go to politicology.com/plus, or just open the show notes for this episode and click the link right at the top. Okay, on Monday, Iowa held the first contest in the least interesting Republican primary cycle. And as we were discussing the show, I actually thought about tweeting the yawn emoji because the actual result was not in doubt. The race was so uncompetitive that there were caucus sites that hadn't even started speeches when the race was called for Trump. The AP, Fox, CNN, CBS News, and NBC all called the caucuses for Trump around 7:30, around a half hour after they were scheduled to start. Reporter Ben Jacobs, who was actually at a caucus site, been on the show before, tweeted that they hadn't started speeches when the race was called. The DeSantis campaign was very upset that the race was called for Trump so early. I should note there's a big difference between calling the race before everyone has voted, like on Monday, and calling the race after voting has ended, based on the early returns like Trump complained about Fox doing in Arizona in 2020. Because calling the race before people voted can actually impact the way people vote. But in any case, Trump won with 51% of the vote, which means that 49% did vote for someone other than Trump at the caucuses. And I think that number has been mischaracterized. Dave Weigel from Semaphore pointed out that on X, formerly Twitter, that several of the Trump alternatives are aligned with Trump. So if you look at, you know, Trump plus DeSantis plus Vivek, you end up with 80% of the vote. And my ride or die at Politicology here, Mike Madrid, pointed out this is the right way to look at the numbers, but that 19% is still a devastating number for Trump. So Vivek is now out. Also, he's endorsed Donald Trump. What have you made of this idea that somehow 49% of Iowa Republicans were ready to move on from Trump because they voted for someone else on Monday night, Liam?
I think it is simultaneously a cope from people on the right who want to get rid of Trump, and it is a motivated reasoning among those on the left who want to see signs that actually he's weak and that the general election polling is a mirage. Look, if anybody believed that Trump was going to Cruz to 50% of the vote in a state that he didn't even compete in, and mind you, lost in 2016, they wouldn't have gotten into this race. I mean, this is, I think we're fine to judge this as an incumbent campaign if we are consistent in that judgment. Nobody treated this that way. And so it ends up being this sort of circular proposition that, you know, had it been expected that Trump would vanquish his, you know, what at one point had looked like a quite formidable challenge with all the attendant hype around it, then we wouldn't have had this tested. I think there's sort of a Schrodinger's element of, if left untested, the incumbent looks strong. The reason we never test that proposition is people don't want to run headlong into a buzzsaw and lose. It's part of why Biden hasn't been tested. You know, you look at numbers saying 2/3 of Democrats want a different choice, and you have somebody like Dean Phillips jump in and say, "Hey, here I am. You know, come vote for me." People don't actually want that, and it's why some of the theoretical polling against Biden is like Biden still gets. People might want something else in the abstract, but when forced to choose between, you know, the guy you're not crazy about and the alternatives, you're probably going to go with the guy you're not crazy about. Now, I think that the notable thing is if you're looking for signs of weakness, the question is which of these people won't end up voting for Trump if and when it's a binary choice between him and Biden. And the only group where that's even a question is that 19% you mentioned. It's that Haley cohort. So I think if you're digging into those numbers, that's why the Weigel frame is the correct one. The DeSantis people are going to have no problem getting behind Trump. They would have had a problem getting behind Haley, perhaps. But I think that's the question, is that cohort in Iowa that the exit polling said would back Biden over Trump if Haley's not the nominee. That's the sort of people you have to think at scale. Is that going to be something that affects this election? I think that's what we need to come away with as the signal.
Alex, how long are we, well, I should mention, Trump beat DeSantis by 30 points, Haley by 32 points. And the New York Times pulled out, you know, their famous needle to show the likelihood that DeSantis or Haley was going to come in second place. So my question really from a journalist perspective is, how long are we, and I mean the broad we, going to pretend like, you know, who's finishing 30 plus points behind the front runner actually matters in this race? Because I can tell you, as a strategist, I've been really frustrated and sort of like throwing up my hands at the way the media has been covering this primary as if it's a real primary.
Well, I would defend the robust coverage up until Iowa because people hadn't voted yet. We were just depending on polls, even though I think we all saw the writing on the wall, and you know, Trump is basically a semi-incumbent. But I think, you know, it was worth really, you know, probing these candidates and giving it robust coverage. Now, to answer your question, how long are we going to wait? You know, the over answer is basically South Carolina. And that's like the longest it's going to go. If Trump is as 30 points ahead in South Carolina, this is over. And I don't think you're going to have any media really give any credence to anyone challenging Trump. I think also this could mostly be over next Wednesday. If Trump beats Nikki Haley by double digits in New Hampshire, which demographically is by far her best state and sort of an outlier in terms of the Republican primary electorate, both in its level of college education and the fact that you have independents voting there, you know, we could be talking about the general election matchup, you know, starting next Wednesday.
Okay, I'm going to dial Mark in, guys.
Hi there.
Hey. Okay, you're here with Liam and Alex and I, and we're just tuning into the Middle East. So as of last night, it looks like the U.S. has launched a fourth attack on the Houthi rebels. It feels like things are escalating more quickly than we would have anticipated. Can you sort of zoom out and give us some context for what's going on right now and sort of answer the question that I think is on a lot of people's minds? Are we sort of barreling toward the U.S. sort of being deeply involved in another war in the Middle East?
So, Ron, it's a great question, and I think the answer is not yet. And so it's easy for us to say, okay, we're now in a regional war. We're in a regional proxy war with Iran. That's maybe a little more accurate. I would just call it, you know, kind of this low-intensity conflict is boiling up a little bit. But, that you know, we don't see shooting wars across, you know multiple areas of operation yet. And I'll just throw into all this, which, of course, you cannot help but kind of shake your head. Who had on their bingo card an Iran-Pakistan exchange across border? So, you know, really interesting times, a lot for the National Security Council, for the Biden administration to work on. But I don't think kind of this end of day scenario is warranted yet.
Okay. And why not? Can you walk us through what's been happening and why?
Sure. So, you know, let's break it up. And if you think back to what the Israeli defense minister Gallant said several weeks ago, that Israel was fighting a six-front war. But in essence, now the United States is fighting a three-front war, but again, low intensity. And so let's start with kind of the Iranian proxies in Syria and Iraq. And so, you know, our U.S. bases, both in Iraq, maybe numbering 2,000-plus personnel, Syria, several hundred, but they're being hit by Iranian proxies. And we're firing back, and we have to, you know, that we have to kind of reestablish that deterrence. That's important. And then you move to the Red Sea with Yemen and with the Houthis, who, again, another Iranian proxy, who essentially have decided to kind of almost shut down international shipping. 14% of, you know, the kind of shipping goes through that area. And so the U.S. was absolutely obliged to take action because the Houthis were hitting, foreign flag vessels, also shooting occasionally ballistic missiles even and drones at U.S. ships. So we had to take this action. You know, I think that it would be naive to think that the U.S., you know, the first U.S. strikes on Houthi targets was just going to be a one-off. You know, this might take a couple rounds, but we have to kind of reestablish deterrence. And, you know, there's no desire for escalation, certainly on the United States part. I think the key is in Tehran, because at the end of the day, the Iranians really are pulling the strings here.
Okay, I have one other question for you, and then I'll see if Liam and Alex have questions here to get to. But I'm wondering what it says that the Houthis so far have only been firing on U.S. and European vessels and have basically left the Chinese and the Russian vessels alone.
Well, I mean, I think that is certainly kind of, you know, by design. And, you know, there's a big debate now that you see in the press. And I think we're almost have this a little bit of wordsmithing here. Some word salad is, you know, the degree in which the Iranians are dictating Houthi actions. And so, you know, the Houthis are firing at ships, occasionally firing at U.S. Naval ships. The Iranians are providing tactical intelligence, but I think the administration is bent over backwards, saying that they don't see the Iranians kind of directing day to day. You know, in essence, I'm not so sure about that. But then it goes to, you know, what are Iranian goals? And of course, Iran's alliance, certainly with Russia as well. And the Chinese, certainly 100% happy to see kind of the U.S. struggling. So there is some great power competition in here, but essentially this really goes back to kind of this struggle between the United States and Iran. And the ball really is in the Iranian court. I mean, there's been a lot that said that Iran doesn't want to escalate, but one of the things that kind of concerns me, and I think concerns many others, is what if one of these, you know, Houthi, you know, drone or cruise missile, ballistic missiles actually hits a U.S. naval vessel, kills American military. Are we going to just retaliate against the Houthis? We're doing that already. I think that's the chance where things spiral out of control and we're going to have to hit targets in Iran. And so that's kind of the key flashpoint there. Let's flip over just for a second to Israel and not just Israel, Gaza and Hamas, but what's happening in the north. And that's the other big flashpoint. If you worry about some kind of big confrontation, and that's the notion that the Israelis, who have 80,000 of their citizens displaced, certainly are kind of climbing the escalatory ladder with Hezbollah. And if, again, Iran, who in essence is going to call the shots on this key issue, if ever Hezbollah was to rain ballistic missiles, and these are not rockets that Hamas fires from Gaza, these are ballistic missiles into Israel, I think that U.S. carrier group, the U.S. subs with 150 Tomahawk missiles, or kind of the combined power of that naval strike group, they're going to get involved. Now, that's the other way the U.S. can get involved in this war. So, you know, lots to be concerned about, but I don't think, again, we are at a shooting war on all a major shooting war on all these fronts, but more this kind of low intensity boil.
Okay, Liam, Alex, do you have any questions for Mark while we have him?
How long can we expect this to go on? I mean, obviously that's like a loaded question, but I'm just thinking about this from a political standpoint in terms of, I'm thinking electoral impact. Is this something that we should, like the type of piracy that's happening here, is this something that's just sustainable for an extended period? Should we expect this to go on indefinitely, or?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, this is still under kind of the authorities that the president of the United States has. I don't see any kind of, you know, there's been some kind of, you know, clamor from the left and even from the more kind of from the hard right about getting congressional approval. I don't think we're at that state, you know, whatsoever. Again, in essence, a lot of these are just by definition defensive strikes. But, you know, if things kind of kick off with between Israel and Hezbollah in the north and the U.S., you know, using, you know, our, you know, carrier wing are actually hitting targets in Lebanon, I think you might get more of a, you know, some more kind of domestic considerations on that. But, you know, I look at, you know, domestic politics here, and in the one sense, it's very easy to criticize the Biden administration on but this is tough. You know, Blinken is faced when he goes to the region with the U.S. not being a kind of an international pariah at all on this, but just a bit isolated from the rest of the world based on our blanket support from Israel. I think we're doing the right thing. But then he also finds an Israeli government, the government of Prime Minister Netanyahu, is not cooperating on kind of some of the key issues, particularly talking about the day after. So, you know, the domestic side of that is, in my view, the politics side of it is, what if the Israelis kind of keep pushing back on this notion of the day after? You know, what does Biden do? Does he threaten to withhold aid? Do we perhaps abstain rather than veto a UN Security Council resolution as we roll into towards November? I mean, those things are kind of, you know, how much does Biden actually press the Israelis? I think that's, to me, kind of the biggest electoral issue of this in terms of U.S. politics.
Okay, there's another thing on my mind, which is last weekend the IDF announced that they had uncovered a Hamas terror network planning attacks in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East, and including a planned attack on Israel's embassy in Sweden. And I'm wondering what you make of the reports about Hamas planning wider attacks, including in the United States, and whether that's something they're sophisticated enough to do. Because my understanding is that, you know, as terror organizations go, Hamas has been for a long time, you know, kind of a clownish organization and not sort of at the level of, you know, ISIS's sophistication. But how should we be thinking about that?
Well, I think, you know, it's a great question. Certainly something the counterterrorism community is going to be really, really focused on domestically in the United States. That's the Joint Terrorism Task Forces. That's the kind of multi, you know, level entity housed in FBI offices in cities all over the country. And of course, then we have our bilateral intelligence partnerships. But it's the notion of Hamas, which for a long time was a very capable organization in terms of their operations in Israel. But it wasn't forward facing. It wasn't in a sense like Hezbollah or Al-Qaeda or ISIS, where they can conduct attacks externally. Now, Hamas does have an extensive overseas network in terms of fundraising. And there has been some activity in the United States. There was a Hamas operative arrested several years ago, I believe in Brooklyn. But again, it was never the notion that they would conduct these attacks externally. That said, you know, I don't think anyone wants to be surprised. And so I'm sure, you know, both law enforcement domestically and then CIA, NSA, you know, DIA, our intelligence organizations with our foreign partners are really looking at this. And then the added part of this on top is, of course, Hamas is allied with both Iran and Hezbollah. And both of those, Iran is a state actor, Hezbollah, really the A-team of terrorism, frankly, before Al-Qaeda. They both have very sophisticated external operational capabilities. So, you know, those arrests that we saw in Europe should be of concern. Clearly, you know, it's going to take some very aggressive counterterrorism activity from with our partners overseas. But this is something where, you know, when they say that, you know, the light is blinking red, I'm sure that's the feeling within the USIC on this, because, you know, at the end of the day, the longer this conflict goes on, and if the United States gets more involved, that's the other question. If the U.S. actually, you know, is in some way ends up striking Iran, or U.S. is involved militarily with Hezbollah, I think you may see attacks on U.S. facilities, certainly overseas, but perhaps domestically here as well.
Okay. Last question, then we'll let you go. And then we're going to pivot to the domestic politics of all of this and Congress. But my question is, if you're sort of just observing what's happening in the Middle East, what event or events are you looking for that would signal we're about to go to war with Iran? What would sort of force the U.S.'s hand and our allies' hands into sort of an escalating war that involves Iran and all of these other groups that you've mentioned?
I think that if there was a kind of a catastrophic event such as the Houthis successfully sinking a U.S. Navy warship, killing scores of U.S. sailors, I think you will see U.S. strikes on Iran. That's number one. And number two has to do with, again, the war in the north between Israel and Hezbollah. If that kicks off in a very, you know, significant fashion, the U.S. then responds militarily in Lebanon, you might see the Iranian proxies then start hitting U.S. bases in Syria and Iraq. That could cause a response. And the final is, again, the terrorism issue. If there are terrorist attacks against American facilities, I think more likely overseas, but even domestically here, and you trace it back to the Iranians, I think that would almost certainly call for a response. And because ultimately it's the notion of, you know, not only holding the Iranians responsible, but our kind of our deterrence capabilities will have clearly failed. And so, you know, again, there's the region's at a really kind of dangerous time. But again, I think that the administration has done a fairly good job in trying to mitigate all this. It's just there's room for miscalculation. And one last piece, Ron, that I think we really have to talk about is, you know, the conventional wisdom when we say Iran does not want to escalate or Hezbollah wants to stay in power in Lebanon, does not want to see a war with Israel. Remember the conventional wisdom, the conventional analysis about Hamas on October 6th was that it was there was kind of this detente, this peace with the Israelis, that Hamas was happy. They were letting 19,000 workers into Israel. They were much more focused on kind of building the economy in Gaza. And the conventional wisdom and the analysis was totally wrong. Hamas, in fact, had been planning for a year for, in essence, an invasion of a 3,500-man army into Israel. So I think we have to be, you know, we have to have a little humility here, and that maybe some of our analysis on these groups is wrong, and worst-case scenarios certainly should be considered.
Okay, Mark, thanks for squeezing in a call on this. We appreciate your insights, and I look forward to putting together a longer-form discussion on this when we can. Appreciate it.
Sure thing, Ron. Thanks so much.
Okay. Guys, so looking domestically, Biden's taking fire from the extremes of both parties over the strikes on the Houthis. So on the left, Alex, you've got people like Pramila Jayapal and Ro Khanna, and on the right, it's people like Mike Lee. This is over the president's ability to take military action without Congress declaring war, something that has come up time and time again. There's an inherent tension, obviously, between the Constitution giving Congress the power to declare war and the president being the commander-in-chief of the military. And under the War Powers Act, the president can't commit armed forces to military action for more than 60 days without congressional approval. And Biden informed Congress of the attack on Friday, as he was required to do. So that clock is now ticking. My question is, well, there's two real sort of sides to this, the policy Congress question, and then there's the politics of this on the presidential campaign. So why don't we take the policy Congress question first, which is what's going to be the tolerance to the military action on the Hill? How are you reading the dynamics there?
I think the tolerance is going to be pretty high in terms of actual direct action. I think you're going to see a lot of, you know, angry press releases, including from, you know, members of Biden's own party, you know, people freely giving quotes to reporters. But in terms of actually reining in the Biden administration, I don't see a huge appetite for it, in part because Democrats, you know, don't want to be seen as weak when it comes to foreign policy stuff, and Republicans don't have the majority in the Senate. That's my read.
Liam?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a complicated dynamic. I think it compounds the coalitional challenge that Biden has keeping the left together. I think in Congress you have people that understand this and understand the nuance, but I think it's been interesting to watch the reaction certainly online and among people who are already frustrated with the foreign policy stance of Biden. And it all just sort of the friction there, the existing angst over the administration's position on Israel. And the way this overlays to that, I mean, it's this ancillary conflict that is, it's not the same. It's stems from it at some level. The Houthis are certainly, you know, citing this as the reason that they're taking these actions. And so it's really hard to separate, even if you think it's the right thing to do. I mean, the thing that I'm thinking about from a political standpoint is, and the reason I was curious about the question of how long this goes on, because this has real impacts on the global economy. When you think about the impact on the cost of fuel, on the cost of goods, as people have to go around the Horn of Africa rather than coming through, the normal shipping lanes. And so these are things that, even if the foreign policy stuff stays at a low simmer, has real impacts at a time when the Fed and you know, a lot of smart economic minds are really trying to see if they can thread this needle. And it seems like they're so close to getting that soft landing we've all been looking for. The last thing you need is shocks to the international trade markets, the international energy markets.
Yeah. So I think that's totally right. Let's sort of look at how this may impact the presidential campaigns. And Alex, maybe you can lead off here. But if you think about, you know, the contrast between Trump versus Biden campaigns, sort of very, very crudely, as one guy, you know, potentially got us into another war in the Middle East, right? That's how it will be spun. And then the other guy, you know, wants America to retreat from the global stage and abdicate leadership to China and Russia. How do you think those dynamics then, you know, pit against each other? How does this net out politically?
It's been fascinating to watch, because Biden, when he came into office, you know, talking to people that had advised him for a long time, one of the things he really wanted to do was to, quote unquote, end the war on terror. He wanted to sort of close the book on what he considered that era of American foreign policy. Remember, when he was withdrawing from Afghanistan, he initially announced the withdrawal date as September 11th, 2021, literally the 20-year anniversary. And so a big part of what he wanted to do was to extricate America from the Mideast. And what we're seeing, you know, I think it's possible that we may look back on this era as just the wars on terror, one sort of elongated, because every single time there is a quote unquote pivot to Asia or to China, the region still keeps sucking us back in. In terms of how he's navigating this politically, you know, and Liam's point was really smart, is the longer this goes on, the also bigger chance there is for the miscalculation that they were talking about before, or, you know, an attack on American troops. Now, Biden has made it very clear that he wants to de-escalate and to try to still sort of, you know, patch this back together, his Middle East agenda. But the problem is that if, you know, the domestic politics can change, you know, immediately. If there is a huge attack on U.S. troops, you can, you know, go back in American history, whether or not it's, you know, the Lusitania or, you know, and more controversially, the Gulf of Tonkin. And when you're going into a presidential year, when, you know, the rest of the party is basically saying that you're weak, this could escalate very quickly. And, you know, the last thing I'll say while I'm vamping here is that, you know, Donald Trump's rhetoric is so interesting. You know, to your point, he's basically saying, you know, I'm going to retreat, you know, America first, you know, get out of these foreign entanglements. But one thing that I have found interesting, not just him, but DeSantis too, is that a lot of the rhetoric, especially when it comes to Muslims and Islam, really reminds me of sort of like, you know, early W era Republican politics too. You have, you know, DeSantis, you know, talking about how Bethlehem's a pigsty now run by Arabs. And you have Donald Trump saying he's going to kick out, you know, foreign students who support Palestine. And, it is an interesting combination of isolationism and, like, you know, some nativist rhetoric, too.
Yeah, Liam, I think Alex is making a really great point, which is just that the specter of another war in the Middle East invokes the legacy of W, right? Inevitably. And so, with sort of that hanging in the background, how do Trump and Biden navigate the politics of war in the Middle East? And, you know, we can remember, you know, all the way back to September 2001, we got this rally around the flag effect after an attack on the homeland. So George W. Bush enjoyed, you know, monumental domestic support for whatever action he chose to pursue. We didn't have that this time. We didn't have an attack on the homeland. And in this case, this all started because of a military alliance we have with another country in the Middle East, arguably a key democratic ally in the Middle East, but it's not the same. So how do you see this playing out?
Couple things. I mean, I think first and foremost, which just has to be gotten out of the way, and it brings me no joy to say this, but I don't know that you would get the same rally around the flag effect in this environment, in this cultural environment, in this zeitgeist. It does not seem like the kind of thing. If you had something catastrophic happen, I don't know that the environment fosters the sort of civic rallying effect that we're sort of used to and we tell ourselves stories about. So that worries me, number one. Number two, I think you have to remember, not just in this area, but in all respects, Donald Trump's superpower, among other things, is being able to be on all sides of all issues. He doesn't have to be bound by, he has no shame. So like shame doesn't keep him in check in consistency or telling the truth and things like that. So he can simultaneously, create, I think he sold himself very well as somebody who had opposed the Iraq war even back then, which isn't really true. But, he said enough things in different places that you can kind of point back and say, yeah, he was prescient and, he was ahead of other Republicans on this stuff. He can say that Hillary's a warmonger, that neocons are bad, and tap into things that they've been since the late W era. I mean, these are issues that the Republican Party never fully reckoned with, in part because, you immediately switched from late stage W to like Obama bad. But there are some unresolved issues that you're seeing playing out. I mean, and this, I don't want to skip around too much, but like if you're watching the proxy battle between the Trump people and like Haley and trying to keep her off the ticket, like there are underlying issues of that America First stuff, the non-interventionist populist contrarian stuff versus the old school neocon impulses. So like that, setting that aside, like that's a real tension. But the beauty of Trump is he doesn't care about these things, so he can just play to whatever audience. And he understands that there is a weariness around war. There's a skepticism around elite foreign policy consensus. And he can lean into that while also saying, hey, I'm the most militaristic guy there is. And I can, I have a bigger nuclear button than you do. So none of it has to be consistent because that's not who he is. He just sort of does his thing. Now, the flip side is that Joe Biden, he's been in politics, in elected office for, 55 years at this point. And if you look at his career and what he's most passionate about, I think the pinnacle of his senatorial career, with due respect to the judiciary and Supreme Court, is running the foreign policy or foreign relations committee. He thinks of himself as a foreign policy mind, fancies himself a deep thinker on these issues. So even if the domestic policy things he's willing to farm out to people, he cares deeply about these things. And he thinks deeply about these things that requires a level of nuance that Trump doesn't have to abide by. So it creates this sort of asymmetry that exists in a lot of things, but particularly in this way. And understanding that there is such a wedge here with respect to the coalition on the left, it allows Trump to pick at these little things and sow discontent in a way that I think gives him an advantage, even though he doesn't have a leg to stand on, but because he's not susceptible to the same charges of hypocrisy that most politicians are, he can just sort of, kind of run through it.
Just to Liam's point, because, in New Hampshire, and Trump having it both ways, it was really striking to me where, on the trail last 2 weeks, he's like, we're on the closer to World War III than we ever have been. But at the same time, the militaristic side, he keeps bragging, I defeated ISIS. They said it was going to take 4 years. Like he's bragging about military achievements, too. And, about the intra-party discourse, I went to Nikki Haley's stump speech here in New Hampshire last night. And, my takeaway is like, man, she would have destroyed Mitt Romney in the 2012 Republican primary, because she was just like articulating, why it was so important to keep supporting Ukraine and to support Taiwan and to support Israel. And, there was a lot of nodding heads in the audience, but it wasn't there wasn't the roar of the crowd that you hear at some of the Trump events.
This is interesting to me and actually dovetails with the question I was just about to ask you, which is the sort of I see as a on the Democratic side anyway, because as you mentioned, Nikki Haley's making this case, but the sort of argument for or explanation for why American leadership in the world is essential. And it seems to me, and I've mentioned this a few times on the show, but and I will use this as an example, but in Biden's Oval Office address after the October 7th attacks in Israel, he gave this fantastic speech from the Oval, but for me, it was lacking one thing, because he's talking about going, you know, overseas. When he goes to Ukraine, he carries with him the idea of America. And I see this very big, you know, wide open lane for any like articulate leader to explain to America or make the case to America that American leadership is in the world is good. It's a good thing. Or even if you don't think that, what is the role of America in this world that is increasingly sort of, as a lot of the sort of foreign policy folks are calling it, multipolar, right? So if we have a sort of disintegrating alliances everywhere, what is the role of American leadership in the world? And I haven't heard a lot of that coming from the Democratic political sort of machine. I think Nikki Haley might be the only one on the Republican side who's actually doing it. So that leaves a big vacuum in terms of what the hell we're doing here. And in order to sell a war, you have to explain to people what the hell we're doing here.
Yeah, well, you know, I think one problem with that is, you know, Joe Biden, despite having, you know, I think he can rally himself and do these good speeches, but he's not in a place at 81 years old where he can be doing this every single day and make a dynamic speech. In terms of, you know, some of the reason I also think goes back to something Liam said before, which is, you know, people are also, I think politicians are listening to their voters and reacting to their voters rather than trying to lead them somewhere they may not want to go. And the fact is that, you know, there was a, you know, George W. Bush, you go back to that second inaugural address, it was a full-throated articulation of America's role in leadership. And I think that there is a deep skepticism in America, a worn outness in the feeling that their lives, that like, yeah, it's great, you know, that sounds good, but you got to make my life better first. And I think you are seeing that attitude on both, you know, throughout the country. And that's why I think a lot of politicians are not making that argument, is because they sense that voters may not want to hear it.
Let's turn to the Democratic primary. New Hampshire is right around the corner as we tape this on Thursday. You're hearing it on Friday. A lot of people have spent a lot of time talking about the Republican primary, where Trump is leading by 30 points, but not a lot of time talking about the Democratic primary, where Biden has a similar lead. There are a couple of things to factor in here. One is the changes to the Democratic primary calendar. So in February 2023, the DNC essentially rubber-stamped the reconfigured primary calendar that the White House proposed last year. They moved South Carolina to first. They did this because South Carolina is better for Biden. It's the state where he emerged as the front-runner in the 2020 primary after Bernie had won in New Hampshire. And then following South Carolina, it's Nevada, and then New Hampshire, followed closely by Georgia and Michigan. But, New Hampshire actually has their first-in-the-nation primary status enshrined in state law. And they are sticking with their date next week. And Biden did not even bother to file his paperwork to run there. So his name won't be on the ballot on Tuesday. However, key state Democratic leaders are running a write-in campaign on his behalf. So the DNC has responded by saying, you know, they are not going to award delegates at their convention in August based on the New Hampshire primary. Basically, you can vote for whoever the hell you want, but we're not going to count them, which kind of offends your democracy sensibilities. Dean Phillips and Marianne Williamson are on the ballot. Phillips is a Minnesota congressman who's decided to challenge Biden for the nomination. He's trailing by about 30 points, New Hampshire. His family owns the distilling company that makes UV vodka and Belvedere, so he's got a lot of money. He can self-fund his campaign, and he's been focused on trying to jumpstart his campaign in New Hampshire. He hasn't been drawing an ideological distinction between himself and the president. In fact, in Congress, he's voted with Biden 100% of the time. But in a recent profile, Phillips told Ben Jacobs that if Biden was polling better against Trump, Phillips wouldn't even be running. So the question is, what does success or at least a non-embarrassing showing look like for Biden in a state where he's chosen not even to be on the ballot? And what does success look like for somebody like Dean Phillips, I guess?
So I think the problem is, and this goes back to the original sin of trying to meddle with the primary calendar, it probably made sense at the time. I'm sure that they had a reasoning to do it. But given that there was never going to be a real primary, I'm not sure quite why he decided to tick off, important kind of grassroots and grass tops in key early states. So, he sort of made his bed. And he's going to have to lie in it in the sense that he's not going to get hugely gaudy numbers, the kind that will, say, oh, wow, Biden's stronger than we thought. In any event, he's going to be dogged because, the fact that he had to run this write-in campaign that, I don't know, still there's a percentage that don't vote for him. But look, it's very obvious from the performance of Dean Phillips in the polls, from the performance of Dean Phillips on the stump, that there's not a market for what he's selling. I think the premise was interesting to test, which is, oh, this president looks and sounds weak. People say they want an alternative. I present myself and I will be greeted as a liberator. That's just not the way it works. I mean, people might say they want a generic Democrat, but they don't literally want a generic random congressman. So I think there's no way for Dean Phillips to come out of this looking improved or like he has a shot. The only challenge for Biden is just running up those numbers as much as possible. At some level, he's competing with Haley. And I think that's one of the tricky things is as Haley seeks to pull off the big upset over Trump, she's going to be relying on independents and Democrats. And that's typically what happens in New Hampshire is you have a big pool of independents. And when there's not a competitive contest on the Democratic side, you see people cross over. So I think both things can happen. I don't think there's going to be enough of that interest to get Haley over the top, but I think that comes directly out of Biden's write-in pocket if it's going to Haley. So I think it was probably a mistake to meddle with this at this stage. He probably could have done that maybe after he gets renominated. In the long term, it probably makes sense for Democrats to shift around that primary calendar, but otherwise it comes across as a little bit vindictive, and you can hear it in the ambivalence of New Hampshire leaders saying, I really hate what he did, but he's my guy. And it's a complicated political marriage at this point.
Alex, what are you thinking?
Well, I just wanted to add one other thing. Despite some of the criticism of Biden from Democrats and his political team as being hapless, Dean Phillips is getting a real lesson in really tough politics. Because not only, regardless of this sort of kerfuffle over New Hampshire, Dean Phillips is no longer going to be on the ballot or is not going to be on the ballot in Florida, North Carolina, probably Wisconsin. And that's because those state parties have individual rules and they rule that Joe Biden's going to be the only one on the ballot. And Dean Phillips has tried to make hay of this issue. But that also means that this is a delegate fight and he's not going to be eligible for delegates. And it's been really interesting to see the Biden team basically just bring down the hammer to avoid any sort of competitive primary.
Yeah. So I think Dean may actually come on the show to explain some of this because I've been wondering, like, what exactly is the path here? Because I'm not really clear on what the play is, unless he's just sort of counting on Biden having a stroke or something, and then there's a free-for-all. I don't know. But to me, there is this contradiction. Maybe this is why Biden's getting heat from within the Democratic Party. But to me, there's kind of a contradiction between campaigning on democracy, as he has pivoted to now, but also stifling competition within the primary by screwing with the primary calendar, which we've talked about on the show before. It's quite normal for incumbent presidents to not have debates, to, essentially not behave as if there's a primary happening. But it is sort of a step further to rearrange the primary calendar for your own benefit. And it does feel like it's a bit anti-democratic. How serious do you think the criticism within the party has been about that?
I mean, it's definitely anti-democratic, but it's also, he's the incumbent president and he controls a lot of the levers of the party. And it's anti-democratic, but it's also not unusual. In terms of the play for Dean Phillips, I also don't think there's going to be a ton of criticism of Joe Biden. There's going to be some, I think elite criticism of the moves, but I'm skeptical that a lot of voters are going to really rally behind Dean Phillips because they're mad that he's off the Florida Democratic primary ballot. Now, I could be wrong, but I still am a bit skeptical. You know, I did go to a Dean Phillips event up in this little town in New Hampshire the other night, and he sort of did articulate, he said sort of what you just said about Biden having a stroke, but he didn't say it in that many words. He basically said, remember, like, this is a marathon, not a sprint. I am staying in after New Hampshire, and I'm staying in because I do not believe that Joe Biden is capable of finishing this marathon. Which I thought was sort of he was sort of insinuating it, but not quite. I think, but most people in the audience, I think, probably understood kind of what he was saying.
Mm. Yeah. I think, and also a lot of people kind of hear some truth in that. They also have a lot of skepticism. Like, I mean, the age thing is very real. So,
Ron, if we're thinking about a measure of success for Biden, I had to go back and look because I was curious, and I was actually surprised myself. What I do remember from 2012 is Obama having, bleeding 40%+ of the vote in like Appalachian states to colorful characters and that kind of thing. He actually only got 81% in New Hampshire. It was a cast of characters. It was like Vermin Supreme getting votes up there. But that's an interesting test to see if this concerted write-in campaign, as opposed to the ignored campaign of 2012, with this concerted write-in campaign, can Biden run up those sort of Obama 2012 type numbers at the 80-81% level?
Yeah, Kenny Pullen Murkowski.
Exactly.
Last question to both of you, and then we'll turn to our look aheads. But there, he's mentioned a few times, Phillips, sort of there's this media blackout around covering him, and whether or not that's true, I think is debatable. But the Republican campaign has gotten a ton of attention, as we talked about earlier, all over sort of print and TV media. And this is despite Trump's huge lead. But it's largely been a conversation about the other candidates. Why isn't there a similar conversation happening about the Democratic primary? Because I don't see very much of it, if any of it, on sort of traditional mainstream outlets. Do you have any thoughts on that, either of you?
There definitely is a media blackout when it comes to certain stations. I mean, since Dean Phillips announced his campaign, MSNBC has interviewed him exactly zero times. And that's even to comment on things like, Israel-Gaza war, and, some of those committees are relevant to that. So, CNN, despite holding town halls for people like Vivek Ramaswamy and, lower polling, or similar polling candidates, didn't have a town hall for Dean Phillips. So I think there is a bit of that. At the same time, in some of their defense, this primary, even though the Republican primary, as we've discussed, has not been that competitive, and we assumed it, I think it's basically coming to fruition what we expected as of like 6, 7, 8 months ago. The Democratic primary is even less competitive. So, and as we discussed, it would be much more interesting if Biden had a primary opponent in like a Cornel West model, someone that was challenging him on an issue area, especially like Israel-Gaza. At the moment, Dean Phillips' main issue, I mean, he has like some various policy differences, but his main issue is that he thinks, Biden is ineluctable, and part of that is because he's too old. And so I think that that sort of friction is just not as interesting as, someone that would have a real ideological difference.
Yeah. Liam, any thoughts?
I think two things can be true. Number one is that, in a vacuum, the news cable, the Sunday shows are hungry enough for content and for guests that it would be totally normal to see Dean Phillips and somebody like Dean Phillips on the guest roster. And the fact that he's not is very conspicuous in the sense that they know they don't want to do things that hurt their sources and hurt their contacts with the Biden campaign. That said, you could put Dean Phillips on every Sunday show every Sunday, and it wouldn't create a market for what he has. It's the same reason that, Asa Hutchinson was an afterthought in the presidential race, despite having great credentials and, being nominally, a serious politician. He was on very frequently, and it didn't get him, but a handful of votes. He came in, fifth in behind Ryan Brinkley, who I don't even know who that is, came behind him in Iowa. So I think, Phillips can be mad about this and maybe be right about this, but it's not the reason he's not connecting.
Yeah, I think that's right. I also think Alex's point is important, which is like they're not even talking to him about non-campaign stuff. Like he's on the House Armed Services Committee, and they won't even talk to him about foreign affairs stuff. So I think that's quite conspicuous. Now that we have caught up on some of the most important stories this week, what are you watching develop? Alex, what'd you bring?
I'm really watching this special counsel report that Merrick Garland has promised to release about Biden's handling of classified documents. Now, Donald Trump talks about this all the time on the trail in order to create some sense of equivalency. But my understanding is that this special counsel report, which will detail about, you know, the documents that were in Biden's garage next to the Corvette, you know, will be... There is fear that this is going to be politically damaging in a way that I don't think is quite appreciated in Washington. Besides giving Trump ammunition, I think there's a possibility that you could get the equivalent of like the Mar-a-Lago bathroom photo release or something like it that would be just very embarrassing and will create sort of a whirlwind. And we don't know when the report will be released, but it will probably be in the next few weeks here.
Yikes. Yeah, I think you're right. That will be read as equivalents. Liam, what'd you bring?
This might be cheating, but this relates to the day job. There was a tax deal released early this week. It's probably something I could have written on a, you know, cocktail napkin a year ago. It's been the broad kind of themes that Republicans and Democrats have been dancing around for some time here. This is just the House Ways and Means Committee, so Republican majority, and the Senate Finance Committee, so Democratic majority, working together on trying to do two things. Number one, resuscitate a number of business-related tax provisions that were part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that were sort of made temporary in order to save money to do lots of the things that the TCJA did. They were not meant to expire, but because Democrats were in control and didn't want to do things for business without doing for things for working families, we're sort of 2 years past getting a fix for those. So Republicans want that. And on the other side, of course, the temporary increase to the child tax credit under the American Rescue Plan ran out. I think another thing that wasn't intended to run out, Democrats expected it would be popular enough and supported enough among Democrats they could keep it going. So this deal would tentatively boost, not to the same level as 2021, but boost the child tax credit, make it more refundable, index it to inflation. Both of these things would be really building a bridge to the end of 2025, which the look ahead is frankly how much of our tax code and how much of our economic policy will be up for grabs, depending on the outcome of this election. So that's number one. But number two, in the interim, it's going to be a really interesting test of whether normal things that have broad bipartisan support can still happen in this dysfunctional House, this sort of weird moment politically as we head into election season. So there's a markup happening tomorrow. The House has to decide, the leadership has to decide whether it makes sense for Speaker Johnson to put this on the floor. The idea would be to get this to the floor when they get back from recess. The urgency is because Democrats want this to be retroactive. So it would essentially put money in people's pockets, refund checks in people's pockets for this year, which would then help them obviously coming into November. That's, by the way, a reason why some Republicans might not want to do this deal, because it would be a win for President Biden heading into that election year. There's a lot of game to be played here because the Senate hasn't had its say, but it's going to be an interesting test of whether normal things with broad support can happen.
Oh, that's good, Liam. Okay, before we flip over to Politicology Plus, we're going to talk about Davos. Where can everybody find you on the internet, Alex?
You can find me on X/Twitter, whatever, at Alex Tomp. So AlexThomp.
Awesome. Liam?
I'm at LP Donovan. Got the Substack, lpdonovan.substack.com, and on The Lobby Shop, wherever you hear fine podcasts.
I just started listening to the latest episode. It's really good.
Yeah, we dug into immigration policy. So
yeah, it's, I know.
Typical for you and me.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening today. If you have questions about anything we discussed today, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. Whether it's an episode idea, a topic recommendation, or just a simple note about what you thought, we love to hear from you, and we might even use it on an upcoming episode. Also, if you can head over to the Apple Podcast app and rate us 5 stars and leave a review there, we'd really appreciate it. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. I'm Ron Steslow, and I'll see you in the next episode.